So the question is, what do you get when you put a nationally distinguished climate scientist in the same room with a person who's hardwired to be involved with environmental justice, and another who helped pioneer the modern notion of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and a legend who demonstrated by example the connection between conservation advocacy and a lifelong passion as a hunter and angler? Tonight, we're going to find out. So to begin with Mike Clark, the gentle giant in the room, Mike's been engaged in citizen advocacy for over 50 years, starting with work in civil rights, poverty, and the anti-war movements in the American South and Appalachia. He knows the issues of coal country and has a fascinating perspective and sympathy for workers in the coal fields of Wyoming and Montana. Early in his career, he was a journalist and had a fine eye for photography, which you can see in some of these black and whites, including that of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In the 1980s, Mike became involved with environmental organizations, including Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, and the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. Mike twice served at the helm of GYC, and during his first tenure, he helped lead the fight to stop the ill-advised New World Mine from being built in the Absorcas above Cook City, right on the back wild doorstep of Yellowstone and the headwaters of the Lamar. That successful campaign, the first to tout that there are places more valuable than gold, attracted firsthand intervention from both Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt and President Bill Clinton. Mike has served 9 times as the executive director of nonprofit groups and served on 25 different nonprofit boards. Just look at the symbolism of this photograph. It's remarkable what he's able to capture. And of course, you're going to be seeing this map on several occasions tonight. Here's Mike in front of the mountain that he helped save. Next, Dr. Kathy Whitlock. Kathy is a professor of earth sciences at Montana State and a fellow of the Montana Institute on Ecosystems. Her research interests focus on long-term climate and ecological change, and she spent the last 40 years studying the environmental history of Greater Yellowstone, as well as comparable large landscapes in New Zealand, Tasmania, and Patagonia. I'm going to embarrass Kathy a little. She's a rock star with an introverted personality, and she's been a mentor to countless students, and most notably, she's been a role model for young women interested in the earth sciences. Dr. Whitlock has co-authored over 200 scientific publications and trained over 40 graduate students in her field. She's also the lead author of the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment. She's a fellow of the Geological Society of America and the Association for the Advancement of Science. And notably, she was recently elected to the National Academy of Sciences, the first person from a Montana university to receive the honor. If you all haven't read this yet, I would encourage you to do it, and I would encourage you to circulate it to all of your loved ones, young and old. This climate assessment was a benchmark document. It's really important, and it set the tone for the recent IPCC report that just came out a week ago. And again, Kathy is potentially on the front end of doing a comparable climate assessment for Greater Yellowstone. These are the two big take-homes. Less snow, more rain. This winter, we're going into a period in which we expect it to be warmer and drier, which you know what it means next year. Rising temperatures equal more drought. She really has put climate change at the forefront of where it needs to be. Next, another person that I genuflect in front of, Rick Reese. Rick and Mary Lee arrived in Montana in 1970 to begin his teaching career at Carroll College. He subsequently served as Deputy Director of the State Commission on Local Government and Executive Secretary to the Montana Board of Public Education. Rick and Mary Lee then served as co-directors of the Yellowstone Institute from 1980 to 85. Rick was the founding three-term president of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition and retired from the University of Utah in 2003 to return to Montana. Rick assembled the first ever book that gave substance to this thing we call Greater Yellowstone. He's an avid outdoorsman, though, as he says, he stands in awe of local climbers such as Conrad Anker, Jack Tackle, and the late Alex Lowe. He has his own distinguished background in mountaineering. In 1967, he was part of a team that made a famous rescue of an injured climber on the Grand Teton. It was featured in the recent documentary that aired on Montana PBS, The Grand Rescue. As Rick pointed out, all a bunch of guys from Utah. This is the old Yellowstone Institute, the old Buffalo Ranch in Yellowstone. And of course, this concept of Greater Yellowstone, it really began to be pioneered in the 1980s and 1983 when GYC was founded. Another thing that Rick has been involved with is helping to build the Bonneville Shoreline Trail along the Wasatch Front. Next, we come to Jim Posowitz. Jim was born in 1935. After introducing himself to the joys of hunting, fishing, and trapping, he moved to Montana in 1953 pursuing fish and wildlife management studies. Following graduation from MSU, he spent 32 years with the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, leading the agency's ecological program for 15 years. He also has been an adjunct professor of history and philosophy at MSU. In 1993, Jim founded Orion the Hunters Institute, a nonprofit conservation organization dedicated to the preservation of ethical hunting and wild resources essential to that purpose. In association with that work, Jim has published five books: Beyond Fair Chase, Inherit the Hunt, Rifle in Hand, How Wild America Was Saved, Taking a Bullet for Conservation, The Bull Moose Party, and A Centennial Reflection, 1912 to 2012, and his latest, which I've now read twice, titled My Best Shot, Discovering and Living the Montana Conservation Ethic. In addition to Orion, Jim served as a founding board member and executive director of the Cinnabar Foundation. Numerous groups have recognized Jim for his work. Among the many recognitions are the American Motors Conservation Award, Montana State University's Blue Gold Award for distinguished services which have contributed to benefit mankind. More recent awards include the 2004 Outdoor Life Conservation Award for his contribution to our national conservation effort, the Montana Wildlife Federation Award presented them with their first Heritage Award for a lifetime of service to fish and wildlife in 2010. The Cabinet Resources Group awarded him their Headlamp Award in 2011, and for a lifetime of protecting natural resources and our quality of life. In 2014, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers awarded Jim their Mike Beagle Chairman's Award, and the National Wildlife Federation named Jim their Conservationist of the Year in 2015. In 2016, he was inducted into the Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame. Something else about Jim Posowitz is he's been involved with Greater Yellowstone and really has brought this pure sporting ethic to thinking about hunting and fishing in Greater Yellowstone and the importance. He once played a seminal role in stopping a dam from being built in the upper Yellowstone Valley. He's been involved in a lot of causes, and I like to refer to Jim as Montana's version of Aldo Leopold and Teddy Roosevelt. So just as Leopold was famous for his book, Beyond Fair Chase, The Ethic and Tradition of Hunting, Both of my kids who went through hunter safety read this book. It's really important and sets the tone for what we want to see in hunting. And he's also has been author of these three books, all of which are excellent. This is his latest, Jim Posowitz. So tonight what I'd like to do is I'm going to pose a few questions to get us started, but what I really want to do is turn the evening over to questions from you guys, given the fact and that we have four people here, this quartet, with a wide range of experience. So we're going to start with Mike Clark. Mike has given his papers over to the archives, and a lot of things, fortunately, we're going to learn about these people while they're with us, and we're not reading them in a damned obituary. So that's my great lament as a journalist. I wish that I had been able to know people, and I'm really glad that I've been able to know these four. So Mike Clark, you were a journalist early in your career and then got involved in environmentalism with a lot of on-the-ground field experience in the realm of environmental justice. How did that happen? How has your notion of environmental justice evolved? And how has the environmental conservation movement evolved?
Wow, a lot of questions there. I got involved with environmental work after being frustrated about being a journalist and writing about issues and not seeing much change. And so I decided to become an activist. And I got involved in fighting strip mining in Appalachia and working on black lung disease, welfare rights, issues like that. My main concern has always been in those days was how do you give ordinary people a voice in their future and how do you help them become more powerful? So that's sort of where I came from. And when I moved out west in the early 80s, I learned for the first time really about conservation and wildlife and decided to see if I couldn't help give wild critters a voice also. So it's been a good run, and I very much appreciate living in Montana and being part of this community.
Thank you. Rick Reese, on the end. In the past, you've said you had no real experience in conservation politics or policy until you and Mary Lee moved to Helena in 1970. But all that quickly changed shortly after you settled into Montana. What is it about life in Helena and Montana that led you to what has now become nearly 50 years of conservation advocacy, both in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and Utah?
So, when Mary Lee and I first arrived in Bozeman in 1970, we knew nothing about conservation, and we had had no conservation history. She's pointing at me. Am I doing something? Excuse me, in Helena. Okay, correct me as I go on. we learned a lot about conservation on a very quick learning curve when we arrived in Helena. We met people like Jim Posowitz, Bill Cunningham, Phil and Robin Taney, Bill Bryan, Lennon Sandy Sargent, Ann and Myron Sutton, Bill Schneider, Matt Reed, and a whole bunch of others. We also dropped into a state where Forrest Anderson was governor, and Lee Metcalf and Mike Mansfield were our U.S. senators. And during those first few years when we were in Helena, six new wilderness areas were created and nine wilderness study areas, including the Hyalite porcupine buffalo horn that's right out the back door here. Then the Constitutional Convention came along, and just to give you an idea, if you weren't here, one article in the Constitution bestowed a constitutional right for every citizen of this state to a clean and healthful environment. You can see we got a quick introduction. But all this was 10 years before Mary Lee and I got directly involved in matters related to the Greater Yellowstone. And that remarkable journey began in Helena in 1980 when Superintendent John Townsley came to Helena to suggest that Mary Lee and I come to the Lamar Valley and work on a new project called the Yellowstone Institute. And what a deal. They would pay us $900 a month with no health insurance. We thought that was a non-starter. I went home. I told Mary Lee, what do you think? We both had been were familiar with the Lamar Valley. And I don't have to tell you, the next thing we knew, we were on our way to the Lamar Valley. I resigned my job. We were about to be introduced to the term Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, and we were off to a five-year experience of a lifetime. In wrapping up, we'd only been in Mammoth for a few days when John Townsley went to Cody. He was the superintendent of Yellowstone, to testify in opposition to opening the Washakie Wilderness to oil and gas exploration as proposed by Jim Watt. He came back and came by the house that night and said, listen, let me tell you what I've just been through. And that's when he said, we need to start thinking in terms of a greater Yellowstone ecosystem. It's the first time I'd ever heard the term. Finally, fast forward to October 1982 in the Greater Yellowstone Symposium held in the cafeteria right here at MSU. Bozemanites, Joan and Cliff Montaigne were there, as were Matt and Doreen Reed, John Craighead, Chuck Yockel, Bill Schneider, Bill Cunningham, and a whole cast of others. 8 months later, the Greater Yellowstone Coalition was born, and a strong case can be made for the fact that it started right here on the MSU campus. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Dr. Whitlock, Kathy. You're a member of the National Academies of Sciences and are recognized today as one of the leading thinkers bioregionally on the impacts of climate change in America. You're lead author in assembling Montana's climate assessment. First, how compelling is the evidence of climate change? And second, why should we be concerned?
I'm really, really worried about climate change. I'm really worried about it. I'm worried about what it means for my children, what it means for their children. It's a big deal, and it's a big deal because it's affecting everything. Almost every issue that comes up is going to be and is being impacted by climate change. It's not a standalone issue. It's not something that we can evaluate as a problem here versus other problems there. It affects everything. And we're seeing climate change already. The climate is already changing in Montana. We can see that it's gotten 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer since 1950. We see that our streams are reaching their peak runoff earlier in the year by about two and a half weeks. We've seen, as you could see in the graph, that we're getting less reliable snowpack, it's melting earlier, we're getting peak runoff, and then we're going into drought. So the manifestations of climate change are already here, and the models that tell us what's going to happen in the future are in complete agreement. Montana is going to get warmer, and temperatures, warmer temperatures are going to change everything. It will change precipitation, it'll change snowpack, it'll change stream temperature, everything. So when you wonder what's going to happen in our region, think warmer.
So one follow-up here. We have grandparents, we have parents, we have young people in the audience. So what do you say to your students, and what do you say to young people, to those who and others who feel overwhelmed and paralyzed about the issue?
Well, I can share that sense, but I also think it's an opportunity. I think it's an opportunity, it's a call to action, just as the civil rights movement was a call to action. We have a call to action now, and it's called taking care of this climate change issue. There's huge opportunities for young people. There's opportunities for technological innovation. Just today in the paper, we were reading about MSU scientists who are finding new ways of pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequestering it. That's so exciting. That's such an opportunity. And as I said, we have an opportunity to come together in our communities and talk about a common issue. It's not a political issue, as I'm sure everyone here knows. It's a shared issue, and it really can bring us together, I think.
All right, thank you. Jim Posowitz, more than half a century ago, you were a young man from Wisconsin who fell in love with Montana and came here as an athlete. You weren't dissimilar in being from Wisconsin from two other people from the state, John Muir, whom some people in this audience might have heard of, and Aldo Leopold, whose The Sand County Almanac established him as a pioneer in promoting the modern land ethic. You've made your own great contributions to promoting ecological thinking. You worked for the state for a long time. To survive and not get fired, and I'm only half joking.
How I survive goes back to a little old statement that the Lord looks after fools and drunkards, and I had double coverage. Yeah, we needed to get a clap in the room. One thing, I've never made the assumption of what I couldn't do. A lot of that goes on in bureaucracies. People assume for this reason or that they can't do something. They can't take an action that their position calls for them to take. But the rule I sort of lived by was, make them tell me. I'm not going to make the assumption. And that cuts you a lot of time. And the other way to survive, of course, as part of the survival strategy, is to stay out in the middle of the street. In other words, stand under the light as much as you can, mingle with the public and with the people, and when you really need them in a crunch, they'll be there. And I go back to Bob Dylan song that I used to love hear Joan Baez sing. When you go looking for who's going to get you and going to get your job, and the line in the song is, the face of the assassin is always well hidden. And so if you make them step out in the light, you'll get by, because most of them won't do it.
Thank you. Jim, a follow-up for you. You have really been a scholar in looking at the evolution of the American conservation movement, the development of the North American model of wildlife conservation over the last 120 years. So what do you think about today? What do we need to be paying attention to, given that we've been heired that great legacy?
Well, I think first thing we need to do is revisit that legacy.
I went through a couple of degrees in this institution and never got any history, any philosophy, or any ethics. I was always taught that you are the scientist, you be scientifically objective, you don't have your emotions involved in this, and you gather the data and give it to the decision maker. Well, I never believed that then, and I sure don't believe it now. And I think the important thing, for whether you're a scientist or a layperson, it's important to care and to use your science and be as objective as that discipline requires. But that doesn't mean to stay out of the combat. I know when they moved me into Helena from the field. The first thing I did is I enrolled in Carroll College to took a course in creative writing. And the purpose of that was to communicate. We were, at the time, we were fighting two dams on the Missouri. The Corps of Engineers was butchering the Kootenai and the railroad along the Fisher River. And we had bigger issues just around the corner. And the smartest thing I did was to take that course and use it to communicate to the public. Because in this country, this is one of the few places on the planet Earth where the wildlife belongs to the people. In most countries of the world, it attaches to property and to wealth and to privilege and other things. But that American model started with a court case over oysters in the New Jersey Meadowlands, goes back to 1842, where the landowner said, wait a minute, the King of England gave me this, and it included the fishings, hawkings, huntings, and fowlings. And the oysterman, or the court, ultimately said, by virtue of the Declaration of Independence, the people declared themselves to be the sovereign, and those privileges that attach to royalty attach to the people. And in that decision, the king's deer became the people's game. And that has been the difference in this evolution of conservation in America.
Thank you. Rick and Mike, let's begin with Rick. You've both donated your papers to the MSU Library Special Collections. What are some of the documents that hold deepest personal meaning and that might serve as touchstones for students and scholars down the road?
Mike and I donated papers related to different phases at GYC. Mine starts really the first day I heard the term Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem from John Townsley and goes through the first 3 years of the organization. Then there was a period where Ed Lewis was executive director, and then Mike followed. And Mike's documents pick up there and come forward. So what I had was a little bit of what I recited a few minutes ago. Where did the idea come from, and how did it become popularized, and how do you build an organization around it?
Mr. Clark?
Well, I had a bigger problem. I gave all my papers to MSU, and Kim Scott and King have been working with their staff to sort them out. I'm not sure I can. I do think, looking back over 50-odd years of work, a lot of my work has been about the concept of how do you create and maintain a democracy. And I think in that context, especially as we deal with climate change, we're going to have to rethink what it means to share in this country, what private property means, what public lands means. If you look at public lands, there are only two examples in the world where we have put serious limits on the operations of capitalism, an economic system that has destroyed every wild place it's ever touched. And there are only two places where we say no to that. One is the national parks and the other is the wilderness areas. We need to keep that in mind as we move into a period of climate change and of having to figure out how we share our resources and how we define the future. My papers deal with many, many different issues, from civil rights to war, to anti-poverty work, to environmental justice, and to wildlife conservation. I think probably the most interesting pieces for folks in Montana would be, how do you stop a mine? We did that. If you want to learn, there's some good stories in those papers. And the other one is, what do we think about for the future of Greater Yellowstone? And I've written about that a lot in the last few years, and I would suggest you look at those papers.
Thank you. So let's, since we have Dr. Whitlock on stage, let's jump into a hot topic. This is an issue that's on a lot of people's minds and seldom gets publicly discussed, and that is the general prevailing historic white, especially white male profile of the modern conservation movement and within academia. Reflect on your own journey as a woman who's now making a significant contribution to engendering public understanding about one of the most iconic ecosystems in the world and the most formidable environmental issue in modern human history.
Okay. You know, I've often, through my career, I've been the only woman on the stage or the only woman on a committee. And most of my hires have been through affirmative action. The department needed a woman on the faculty. So that's kind of been my role. And there's always a background of, not harassment, but of sort of sexism that you deal with when you're in that situation. A friend of mine said it's like running a race. Your race is your career, and all the men are running on a flat track, but your lane has hurdles. And when you get to the end, you've worked twice as hard as anybody else in that race. And I think that's true. I think when a woman gets recognition, when a woman gets an award, it's indisputably because she deserves it. She's probably worked harder than you can imagine to get there. It's not a gift, it's not a reward, it's probably very much earned. Now, in the conservation movement in academia, they've been very much patriarchies through their history, but that's changing. We have some really amazing people now in conservation areas. We have, here in town, we have Carolyn Bird running the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, Jody Hilty with the Yellowstone to Yukon. We have Molly Cross running the Wildlife Conservation Society, North American, South American efforts. And at our university, we have the most amazing person leading the university, Waded Cruzado, who's inspires all of us to do better, and she's done enormous things for women. So I think things are looking a lot better than they have, but I have to say it's a hard road, and I just have to say along my career, you know, I've been told that I need to wear more mini skirts. I've been told I need to smile more. I've been told that I really shouldn't be doing what I'm doing because I'm taking a job away from a man. It's a challenge, you know. And so I just think it's, as a woman, it's really important to encourage other women and people from underrepresented groups to have the courage to just keep up the good fight and believe in yourself and go forward.
Thank you. Gentlemen, this is aimed at Jim, Mike, and Rick in that order. The issue of the need for greater diversity and inclusion in the conservation movement and sciences is undeniable. It's also important if things like public lands are to maintain public support and sustain relevancy and not be perceived as an indulgence of elitists. Jump in here, Jim, you jump in first. Riff with a response to what Kathy just said.
Well, I think the wildlife profession and the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks was one of the slowest institutions to diversify and to begin accepting a broader range of students and then participants. And I guess what one does about that is to not forget how long that took and the kind of work that they did once they got within the agency and within the movement. And, in the broad movement context, when Rachel Carson popped up, it was pretty doggone significant. Not because she was a female, but because her work was so competent and so comprehensive. And I think we're kind of over that now, but Gail turned her head the other way. We're almost over that now. And I think also in people of color and different races, and it wasn't just a few weeks ago that Gail and I were up on the Rocky Mountain front meeting with the Native Americans from the Blood Tribe in Canada and the Blackfeet as hunters to talk to them about how we return the bison to wild, free-roaming animals. And so we have to work in both directions to diversify, I guess, and I think that is going on. I don't know how you accelerate it, but I think it's surely accepted now, and we encourage it.
Thank you. Mike?
I've been associated with all the major social movements of this century in America. The conservation movement is by far the most elitist and most sexist of any of the movements, and is very resistant to change. You cannot expect white males to give anything up. It has to be taken. And I think that more and more women are realizing that and moving on it, and I think that's a good thing. When I was running Friends of the Earth, I was part of what was called the Gang of Ten, the leaders of the 10 environmental groups that lobbied Congress, all white male. That has now changed over the years, but it's very, very uneven. And I think that power does not yield without a demand. And women need to be much more defiant and aggressive about what they want. And my experience is if they are, they will get a lot more. You cannot be polite in our society and succeed in gaining power.
Thank you. Rick Reese.
I think it's interesting, very interesting, Kathy, what you said. And when I was growing up in high school, for example, young women were by and large not in trig class, and they were not in chemistry, and they were not in the sciences. Now, today, I know that has changed dramatically, and I think that's very hopeful. When we launched the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, more than half our board the first 2 years were female, and all of the staff was female for a while, especially during those dark days when some of the males got fired. My hope is that we can get many more women in science, and I'm sure MSU is way ahead of me on that, but that has to start in elementary school, and I think we all know that.
Please.
Quick comment. The conservation movement is largely devoid of any Native Americans. And I don't need to talk about the irony of that or the history of that, but if we're going to be valid in this region, we have to find a way to make sure that Native Americans have a powerful voice in what happens in Montana over the next few years.
Thank you. Jim?
Yeah, just a little footnote. The Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame has two Native Americans in it, Thurman Trosper, who was quite active in putting the Mission Mountains into wilderness protection, and Bearhead Swaney, who worked on a variety of environmental issues. And so we're starting in that direction, at least, to recognize those voices out there.
Thank you, Jim. Kathy, I'd like to have a follow-up, please. How do we move from merely identifying the problems and make progress in addressing them so that we're not calling out the fact that this is just a serious problem, but actually remedying it?
Well, I think it's like Rick was saying, we have to get women interested in conservation areas and in science and encourage them and give them opportunities and just be more supportive of them and that effort. It it's changing. It definitely is changing. And the students that I see and their interests, there's, you know, people, we have Native Americans in our lab. We have equal numbers of women as men. It's changing, but we just have to be conscious of it and work towards making it happen.
Okay. One more follow-up for you. Because you're on the front lines of engaging with young people, are students today different from the years when you were a student? And is nature deficit disorder a real serious concern that you see on campus?
I'm looking out at my students here, all grinning at me. There is so much to like about students today. There really is. They're much more confident than I ever was when I was a student. They have a kind of self-assuredness that always amazes me. They're technologically very savvy, and I envy that. They're really just at the cutting edge of technology. Because they social network so much, they are very comfortable in groups and communities. So there's a lot to like about them. And they also really, really like that kind of thinking out of the box challenge. You know, they don't just want to be spoon-fed information. They really want to be hit with something that's going to force them to think, you know, beyond what others do. A lot of the students today are really busy, really, really busy. They're taking 18 credits and they're working a job full time. And I'm sure it shows up in their grades that they're working full time, but they have a lot of demands, and I really am respectful of that too. One thing else about students, though, is they're very recreational, especially students at MSU. They come here because they like extreme sports. They like to go in the backcountry. They like to be on their mountain bikes and, I don't know, ice climb and you name it. And I think they have a different view of nature than I grew up with. And I'll be leading a field trip, and everyone in the back seat is talking about their gear. You know, a trip through Yellowstone, rather than looking out the window at the wildlife. We have to capture them. We have to get them not being so recreational or thinking about wild areas as being places to play, but really wild areas as being places to value. I teach a Yellowstone class. We're the University of the Yellowstone, and we need to make more of that. You know, we really need to be the University of the Yellowstone and give students that experience to appreciate wilderness and wildness and conservation.
Thank you, Kathy. After this, we're going to soon move to audience questions, but I wanted to have a rapid-fire response from the four of you following up on what you just said, Kathy, and that is not only for students but for others who tend to take it for granted, why does the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem matter? Let's start on the end with Rick, and we'll move down to Jim.
Well, because it's one of the largest intact ecosystems remaining in the temperate zones of the Earth, and the Earth is the only place in the universe we know of where there is life of any kind.
Well, I'll reiterate that. It's the last temperate ecosystem, so it's a place where we can study natural processes in ways that we can't anywhere else. And right now we're playing with two knobs in Greater Yellowstone. One is the how many people are we going to let in, and how are they going to use it? And the other is the climate change knob. So in some ways it's a grand experiment and something that we can play out. So Yellowstone's a place for discovery. It's a place for education and inspiration, and it's a place to sort of renew our souls and remind us about what nature is.
Thank you. Mike?
I think in a time of climate change, Greater Yellowstone is perhaps the best equipped refugia in the lower 48 states, and we need to learn how to keep out of it. we've got too damn many people playing in it now, and it's going to be a harmful thing over time. I had a meeting recently with the superintendent of Yellowstone, who says that the visitation rates are climbing at 3 to 4% a year. It's over 4 million people now. In 15 years, it could be 8 million. We can't do that.
I would say it's important if we just stretch it a little bit, and my stretch would to be include the river. The Yellowstone River is born there, and all the things the other speaker said being true, but then that river runs 670 miles free. And along that course of 670 miles, every human perturbation that we've invented to harm the environment will come in contact with that river. And so far, we've held it together, and it's a treasure that we should include in our thing, because it suddenly includes more than just the visitors to the park. It also includes the people stretched along 670 miles, a river that depend on it, require it, live with it, and enjoy it.
Thank you. So now let's open it up to questions from the audience. With four people like these here, it's just a golden opportunity, so we'll have a floating mic out there.
This is really for any of you. So public lands and conservation is absolutely an important issue in Montana. But unfortunately, we tend to confine that concern to borders, and those borders tend to be where we play. And that kind of gives rise to this not in my backyard mentality that doesn't extend to general conservation, whether that's outside of our region or outside of the US, but conservation as a whole across the world is important. So how do we encourage people who maybe care about conservation here but don't see the bigger picture to, you know, get outside of that just not in my backyard mentality and care about conservation as a whole?
Well, I think we have to do a much better job of teaching people the impacts that we're having. And we have to be willing to say there are limits on what people can do and should do. And if you're going to say that, then you got to teach them why that's important. Otherwise, we will whittle away at everything and inadvertently destroy it.
Maybe add to that we have to start teaching the history of how we got this far. And that's a deep history. That court case I talked about earlier, 1842, that's like 66 years after the nation is formed. And the great national saga of these natural resources is a story that has tremendous power. When you realize the generations before you that stood up and put this into your custody, I think that just strengthens your argument for the effort you need to make, or we need to make, to pass it to the next generation.
Quick follow-up for Kathy. You're working with Andy Hansen and other colleagues there, and you're looking at this trying to quantify the impacts that Mike Clark was talking about. Are you making any headway? When you're talking about numbers of people, do you see impacts with recreation?
Well, I think the park people talk about the impacts of recreation in terms of, you know, just tearing up, wearing down the park, trying to find places to park and parking on the road and making new trails and streams being too hot and fish diseases and causing pressure in that way by angling pressures. But when I heard your question, I was thinking about climate change, because, yeah, we all have this kind of not in my backyard attitude, especially when we're lucky enough to live in Bozeman. But some of these issues are just so pervasive that, you know, you can't be in your backyard anymore and solve problems. So I think we need to realize that our local problems are global problems, and all of our global problems are going to be manifest locally, and that's the trick we have to do.
This is a question, and maybe for Jim. There's always been a tension maybe between the federal government and states, especially with hunting, hunting practices on federal land versus state land. And recently, Ryan Zinke has been working to change the hunting regulations in Alaska to be more in line with the states. And he also made the assertion that the federal government has always taken a backseat to the states, which may or may not be substantiated. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you see the role of the federal government and the states in hunting, and we could take broaden it into conservation as a whole if people want to jump in.
Everybody bring a lunch bucket. The Supreme Court in 1842 and then again in 1869 put the public trust responsibility onto the states for wildlife management. The federal agencies, of course, manage a considerable public estate, and that was another incredible classic move by a hunter. And that hunter, and I have to ask my wife to excuse me because she knows I overdo this, but when Theodore Roosevelt got to be president, he set aside 9.9% of America for wildlife protection and for forest protection and restoration. And so there you had the embedding of a conservation ethic passed to agencies to administer for land at the federal level plus unclaimed federal lands, and the wildlife responsibility basically assigned to the state to be managed as public trust. And of course, as we muddle through many generations, it's very important to tell the story about when wildlife was assigned to all people, it was owned by no one in particular, and the commercial interest stripped that resource down to near extinction for almost all species. The most classic example of that was a ranchman who was looking for open grazing in 1883 or 1885, and he rode along the Milk River from the North Dakota border into the Missouri drainage and then up the Milk to the head of the Milk River. So basically riding from the North Dakota border to within sight of Glacier Park. And then Theodore Roosevelt wrote in his book, to use the ranchman's own words, in a journey of 1,000 miles, I was never out of sight of a dead buffalo and never in sight of a live one. Montana became the boneyard of a continent. And now, as we learned just a second ago, we have deer, urban deer problems. We have deer in our cities, bears in our orchards, and goose poop on every golf shoe in Montana. So that's a pretty good recovery story. But the fact is, very few people understand how that was all done. Not only how the federal lands were set aside, but how they were fought through wilderness classifications and other things, and who the heroes were. And they came off the grassroots. You know, Cecil Garland in Lincoln, Montana, ran a country store, and he saved the scapegoat. And yet, I bet everybody here in this room could tell me who left us the Berkeley Pit, because that's what we teach about in Montana history, how we exploit the place. And yet, what do we value? The wild lands and the public lands. And who were the heroes there? Who were the guys that said, no, we're going to set this aside? And that's a hurdle we need to get over, I think, to strengthen the movement, to start recognizing people other than the people who did the most to exploit the place, those who made special efforts to conserve and preserve it. I might have strayed from your question, but my apologies.
My question is for Mike. You know, you said wilderness, wildness, and conservation, and I, you know, especially wilderness. To me, that wilderness is the gold standard for wildlife habitat, especially if it's an important wildlife corridor, which the Gallup Range is to connect the Yellowstone National Park to the Bridgers and the Little Belts. And you know, I've studied the Custer Gallatin Forest proposals, especially the wilderness alternatives. And the wilderness alternatives, there's only one alternative that has wilderness from the park up through the Gallatin Range. The others open it up to backcountry use and, you know, a wildlife management area without, that, you know, is not protected like wilderness. And so the Hyalite Porcupine Wilderness Study Area in the Custer-Gallatin Forest Plan is, you know, appears to be carving up, stopping an important wildlife corridor. You know, tomorrow we're going to have a presentation, and we're going to take, you know, we did a Lighthawk flight to show what the habitat looks like and the impacts to it already. And if people want to come, please see me. I brought some brochures. But Mike, my question is, how important, and Kathy too, in light of climate change, how important is it for wildlife, especially from Yellowstone National Park, to be able to move and move north and in through those, what I want, protected corridors?
Our great concentration of wildlife in Yellowstone Park and some of the surrounding forests only exist because in conjunction with that, you've got the winter habitat, mostly on private lands. And these animals have to migrate in order to survive. If we continue to allow private lands to be chopped up, and if we don't set a high standard for wilderness areas and protect them, the place will erode. Now, we have begun to create around Yellowstone Park concentrations of wilderness and protected lands, and we've almost got the place ringed. So when you look at Yellowstone, the region in general, it is one of the best protected places in the lower 48. But there are gaps, like the Gallatin, that we've got to find a way to address.
I guess when you look at the long time scale like I do, the only way organisms adjust to climate change is by moving. They either go extinct or they move. And that's going to be happening, and it is happening now with climate change. So if we want to give them the possibility of moving and staying in sort of equilibrium with the climate space that they would like to occupy, we need to make that possible.
I'd like to pitch in on this for a second, because one of the problems we have is a failure to differentiate between uses on the landscape and values. And when it comes to wilderness, we are told, really, if you can't dam it, drain it, build it up, knock it down, or otherwise place a dollar sign on it, it's not worth anything. Or if we can't use it in some fashion, and that might be motorized recreation, it might be mountain bikes, a whole range of things. But if you can't use it, it has no value. If you look at this in terms of values, wildlife, water, ecosystem services, all of those things are getting the short shrift here. I was here when Metcalf had Senate Bill 393 and the Hyalite Porcupine Buffalo Horn WSA was designated. It was 155,000 acres. We started out with 350,000 acres, and we compromised all the way down to 155. The proposal now out there is 70,000 acres. And the reason is uses are prevailing over values.
All right, so I am one of Kathy's students in the Yellowstone research class, so I'm doing a report about cutthroat trout populations in Yellowstone, and I came across an article, some research that had been done in 2016 by Idaho Fish and Game, where they had genetically modified brook trout to be YY males. That way they could only pass on a Y chromosome, producing only male progeny. So in that aspect, brook trout are very similar to lake trout. And if it's as simple as what they did with brook trout, do you guys see a genetically modified lake trout in that aspect being brought into Yellowstone in the future?
Bob Gresswell should answer that question.
So
I would just add a caution about genetically modified animals being introduced to a national park. I think you damn well better be sure that we understand everything that's going on before we turn them loose.
Next question, please.
So I just wanted to, I guess something Jim had said that got me thinking was the wildlife went from being like owned by a king to being owned by the people. And you said it became the people's game. And so and when you talk a little bit about the heroes of conservation, wildlife conservation up to this point, I really think all the people that you were probably referring to were mainly hunters. And if you look back through wildlife conservation in the U.S., it's really been funded by hunters who hunting sample, you know, game tags, things like that. And now, when you look at where our management of wildlife is in the U.S., it's really managed as game. And so it's not really the people's animals, it's hunters' animals. And so I'm thinking it's time for a paradigm shift, that it's not, animals shouldn't be just managed for table fare, they should be managed for ecosystems. And so how do we bring that forward? How can the general public say, hey, we want to come to the table and have just as loud of a voice in management as hunters?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. If you look back at where this whole idea of conservation came from, there's one checkpoint in American history when the French sent Alexis de Tocqueville over here to study democracy in America. And they were interested in what they had to hope or fear from democracy. But he noted in a sort of a sidelight way that the Americans themselves are insensible to the wonders of nature. They alter the courses of rivers and drain the swamps as they march across the continent. And they do not recognize the forest before it falls beneath their hatchet. That was in the 1830s, 1835. It's not that America didn't have naturalists arguing. It was Emerson, Thoreau, George Perkins Marsh. But they all lived, argued, wrote, and died before Theodore Roosevelt shot one last buffalo. And it led to his conservation epiphany. And so I think without that step in our society that led to the hunter-based conservation movement, and if you look at its history, it's a pretty interesting thing. And for example, when Theodore Roosevelt was the president, there were 5,000 elk hiding out in the wildest parts of Montana. When Franklin Roosevelt came along after the Dust Bowl in the Dirty 30s and the Pittman-Robertson Act, he tripled that number during his presidency to 15,000. Now there are 10 times that many elk in Montana. So they have the reality of a conservation record that worked. And I think that should give us hope. And you're absolutely right. It belongs to all people. It doesn't belong to the hunter. But I think we need to recognize that the hunter through history has stepped up at critical times. And we start, one of my other favorite examples is one of the most popular wild wilderness hunting area is the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex. The first ranger to ride into that country was a guy named Ehlers Koch. And he rode the backcountry through all that wild country in 1905 and again in 1906. And then he wrote, with the exception of one mountain goat, I never saw or got a shot at a single game animal. That's how bad it was. The story of how that was restored sits two rows in front of you. The guy with the gray hair wrote a book called The Saga of the Sun, and it tells the story of how the hunters and how wildlife was restored to that environment. But the point that this belongs to all people, and of course that was a big part of why I went into hunter ethics and stuff, because we have to remain acceptable to the public as a participant and as an ally. And they have to represent the broader spectrum of public opinion and public will to keep this conservation restoration ethic going. Because if nothing else, it should give us hope. You know, that we went from the boneyard of a continent to one of the most, to the last best place. So there is hope. We can reverse some of these doomsday spirals that we must confront. And there's not many examples around that we could roll out to tell the people this can be done. And I think one line that keeps coming through my brain tonight was Wendell Berry, who was a agricultural writer and later environmental writer in the 70s. And he said, find something within the range of your competence and do it. And we all have to do that.
Oh, I
rambled a bit there,
no,
sorry.
It's great.
So my question is for everybody. I and likely many people here have friends and family who don't believe in climate change or see climate change as sort of a political issue, and I don't really think it should be. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on or advice on starting a conversation with people like that, and kind of how do you get productive results from a conversation with someone who doesn't, you know, quote unquote, believe in climate change?
That's a thing I've thought about. I've been around the state talking about climate change, and one thing is you don't really ask people what they believe. You talk about changing climate, and I never use the word, when I'm talking around the state, I never refer to it as climate change. I always refer to it as changing climate. And for some reason, that little twist makes a difference to people. And I always ask people what they've seen in their lives, especially people that are older. And almost everyone I've talked to, especially people who work on the land, have seen the climate change. That's an observation they've made. And I don't care whether they believe in anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions being the cause. The fact that they're seeing the climate change is common ground for us, and we can go forward. So you might start with that, find out what they've noticed and what they think's going on, and then use that to build on your own, you know, message that you're trying to give them.
I'm going to add one anecdote because we can't get the slide back up, but as a result of Kathy's and colleagues' research, by mid to late century, we're going to see an increase in the number of 90-degree days, an additional 35 days above what we have today that are 90 degrees or warmer.
And I have to say, it's the warm nights that are going to kill me. I can put up with warm days, but when the nights don't cool off, it's like, holy smokes, I can't do that for too long.
Yeah.
As we look forward, when we think about we have to think a little bit about our past, and we've heard quite a bit about that, but we have been a country that has been first generation, second generation rural. Today, we're a country 3 or 4 generations urban, and it's only increasing. The contact to the land, the people that are 3, 4, 5th generation urban, is very different than those of us that came from either the first or the second generation. And so we've got to think that, about that into our equation. When we're thinking, when we're going forward, we're talking about the outdoor and outdoor recreation. Outdoor recreation is an extractive industry. Other natural resource development entities in our state, for instance, we have a College of Agriculture and we've got agricultural experiment stations all trying to deal with adaptation issues, for example. We have a College of Forestry, and we have nothing in the area of tourism. The Tourism Promotion Institute, which is, I said that appropriately, in Missoula, is not able to talk about those things. The head of the director did a news release last spring that fires the year before created $246 million less of income in the state. She was told never to do that again by the Tourism Advisory Council. Okay? My question is that we in the university system going forward, why don't we have a college or at least a program that deals with outdoor recreation and tourism in issues of the future, carrying capacity, the Albert Leopold approach to wildlife also obviously has something to do with our park system and our wilderness areas. And then the other issue is that we have a society that has to deal more with issues of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. How does that fit into the tourism outdoor recreation world? Those are questions. That's a question for you, Kathy, and for Mike. I mean, where do we go from here? I mean, this is a different world than the past. We can learn from the past, yes, but how do we deal with those sort of, my feeling, facts about the future?
Well, I don't have an answer to that. I think you're absolutely spot on. You know, we're very. The university and the way we teach things is very backward-looking, not forward-looking, and I think that's a real. And maybe it's a function of being an ag university. I think tend to be sort of in that mold, but we definitely need to look forward for all sectors of the economy, but especially the growing tourism and recreation aspects. So, I think you're right. I think that's a challenge that we should take on.
I agree with that. I think that if MSU would embrace totally the idea of it being the University of Yellowstone, those kinds of issues could be explored in the academic framework without any limitations. I think the questions of diversity and inclusion are ones that are often hard for all of us here to grapple with in the same way that people do in urban areas. But we're going to have to do that more and more. Montana's becoming much more diverse and much more complex, and we have to be willing to tolerate all sorts of folks with different cultures and different backgrounds in that effort. I think a University of Yellowstone could incorporate all of that.
I just want to add a little caveat here, and I think we want to be extremely careful about trying to justify saving the earth by virtue of how much revenue we can generate from tourists and travel and stuff. Because if you look through history, this public resource was exploited because of the money it could generate. Because buffalo hides made good pelting for the Industrial Revolution and other things. But nonetheless, to make it an economic argument, and an economic argument alone, I think is a serious mistake. And I'll throw in one of my favorite quotes of Roosevelt when he was challenged for all the forest land, for 140 million acres of forest he set aside. He wrote, "This was done for the economic well-being of the people, but there was more where the economic benefit was more remote, but it added to the joy of living and therefore the beauty of life." That's our argument.